Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
On the last episode of Guilt,
it looked, reminded me straight away of Billy T. James. Similar sort of face and that, but this guy had a straight, deadpan face, expressionless face. And sitting beside him was this beautiful blonde.
The other thing is, they also say, well, have you been up to the swimming hole in the Prakawai?
And he would just search for years, walking all the tracks, going off the tracks. It can just consume them.
I was the last one that probably ever saw them alive, and I've never told anybody.
They've obviously been digging, and I've just pulled a bone out. There's a piece of bone right here.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt. In the last episode, I introduced a brand new witness in this case, former landowner Barry Lindsay, who told me of his critical sighting of who he believes was hiding in her barn being driven by a Māori man with an expressionless face down Parakawai Quarry Road late one afternoon in early April 1989. This is the very same remote country road that provides access to the forest block where Urban Hoglund's body would be discovered in October of 1991. According to the police's theory on this case, and the one used to convict David Tamahedi, this sighting should not be possible. Let me remind you that it was the police theory then and today that Heidi and Urban were murdered by David Tamahedi in the remote area of Crosby's Clearing, 73 kilometres away on the west coast of the Coromandel Peninsula. So the question remains, how did they end up here, driving up this remote road? Other than Barry, the last believed sighting of the couple was at a hairdresser's in Thames on Friday, April 7th. In this episode, you'll hear from a new, never-before-heard witness that I believe provides the missing link. Much like Barry Lindsay, this man has sat on this sighting for 34 years without realizing its importance and has never spoken to anyone but me. But before we hear from him, I want to cover an important topic: the timeline of movements of David Tamahedi before and after the disappearance of Heidi and Urban. Is it possible they may hold some vital clues? just to give you a bit of perspective for this area. The Coromandel Peninsula is a large finger of land that juts out from the east coast of the North Island of New Zealand. On the west coast of this peninsula is the town of Thames. It is here that we find Tararu Creek Road and the site Tamahedi alleges he stole the white Subaru. Then on the east coast of this peninsula is Whangamata and the Parakawai and Wentworth Valleys, the location of Barry's sighting and Urban's body. The shortest distance by vehicle between these points is 73 kilometers by car. However, it is possible to cross this distance via tramping tracks through the thick native bush. As the crow flies, not taking into account elevation change or difficulty, it's approximately 23 kilometers. It's difficult tramping, following low river valleys and high ridges. But the point is that it's possible to cross from one side to the other through the bush on foot. It is through this area that we're going to track David Tamahedi's known and unknown movements. My primary material is David Tamahedi's own testimony from his trial, which is useful as it includes reference to witnesses who were able to corroborate where he says he was, although this is not always the case. Let's take a look. Starting on Thursday, March 30th, 1989, 8 days before Heidi and Urban would disappear. Tamahedi tells the court that after a stay at the Sunkissed Lodge in Thames, he leaves and hitchhikes his way to an area not too far south of Thames called Maritodo, where he spends the night at a place called Wires Camp. He tells the court that while there, he searches for a particular track, which he is unable to find. He speaks to a farmer who gives evidence in court that he did indeed meet Tamahedi here. He then states that he packed up his gear about Sunday, April 2nd, and crossed over via the Wires track down into the Wentworth Valley. It is on this downhill stretch towards Wentworth that he meets the mountain bikers David Reed, David Thorpe, and Lynn Patricia Jones, who I spoke of in the last episode. They corroborate Tamahedi's presence around this time. He now claims that he walks into the nearby town of Whangamata for supplies and then returns to the Wentworth Valley, where he grabs his pack and hikes up to a nearby ridge and camps the night. Monday morning, being April 3rd, he states he follows a road through the forest before dropping down off the ridge into the valley, following the Taitoa River. He then follows the river through the forest until it meets with the Kopu Hikawai Highway. Here, he says he hitches a ride over the summit and is dropped at the Paranui track. The people that allegedly gave Tamahedi a ride never came forward. He walks down the Kauranga Valley Road, then stays at the Booms Flat campsite the night of April 3rd. It needs to be noted that this is an extremely long day's tramp, but is achievable. Again, no witnesses come forward to corroborate seeing Tamahedi at Booms Flat campsite. He then tells the court that on Tuesday, April 4th, he follows the Booms track out of Kauranga Valley and up to Crosby's Clearing, where he spends the night camped in the pines. He describes it as being the same spot Jason Donald saw his tent a month earlier, with the note signed Pat Kelly. No one comes forward to corroborate Tamahedi did use the Booms track or stay at Crosby's at this time. On Wednesday, 5th of April, he tells the court he follows the track north, crossing the Tapu Corriglen Highway, where he camps on the other side of a mountain known as the Camel's Back. Again, no one comes forward to corroborate his movements this day. He then spends Thursday the 6th and 7th in the same area, before dropping off the track into the Temitrix River on Saturday, the 8th of April. He tells the court he came out at the coast where he gathered shellfish, then spent the night in a scenic reserve below Tapu. There were no witnesses to these movements on these 3 days. On Monday, 10th of April, Tamahiti says he then carried on down the coast until he reached Tararu Creek Road, which he then walked up. When asked if he saw anybody on Tararu Creek Road or thereabouts, he says he said hello as he passed two old ladies walking a dog. These old ladies were never found. Upon reaching the end of the road, he finds the white Subaru station wagon and steals it, driving it to the Sunkissed Lodge where he checks in for the night. April 11th, he takes three tourists on a tour of the Coromandel. And April 12th, he drives the car to Auckland with the one female passenger who he drops at a backpacker's. She corroborates this story. He then dumps the car at the Auckland train station, pawns Heidi and Urban's tramping packs, and returns home to his wife and children at Blockhouse Bay Road in Auckland, taking with him the Swede's jacket, leggings, and binoculars. Tamahiti tells the court he remained here until the 27th of April, at which time he returned to the Sunkissed Lodge in Thames by bus and stayed for 2 nights. He says he enters the bush and stays for 1 night before deciding to return to Auckland by bus because the weather is too poor. Tamahiti is then arrested on May 24th when he's discovered as a bail jumper for the rape charges. And the rest you know. What you've just heard are Tamahiti's movements, as told by him, from March 30th through to April 27th. Notably, the portions of this timeline that are able to be corroborated by witnesses are the beginning and the end. However, his movements between the dates of April 4th to 10th are completely uncorroborated. Not one person came forward to say they saw him on the forest tracks during this time. No person saw him walking on the roadside, and the people that he says picked him up hitchhiking never came forward. We do know, for a fact, Tamahiti was in Wentworth Campground, 900 metres from where Urban's body would eventually be found, on April the 3rd or the 4th. The next confirmed sighting is him checking into the Sunkissed Lodge in Thames and Heidi and Urban's white Subaru on April 10th. It doesn't mean his movements between those dates didn't happen, but it does mean they're not proven. And what is the reason for the 2-hour trip back from Auckland to the Coromandel by bus on April 27th? Tamahiti claims that he had run into a police officer in Auckland and believed he was about to be sprung, so he fled, only to return 3 days later. If we believe his story, the weather was poor, so he returned home. But it is a curious trip. Back into the same area of bush near Thames. The same area as Crosby's Clearing and Tararu Creek. Remember, at the time of this 3-day trip, Heidi and Urban had been missing for 3 weeks. But of course no one knew this, and wouldn't know for another 3 weeks. You know me. I don't like to sit on my hands. So I wanted to go and visit some of these locations Tamahiti claims he walked during this period. So I was back in the ute, and Ellen and I were off to the Coromandel. So we've come, now I'm just kneeling down in the middle of the road at a road closed sign. We've driven quite a way now, and we're at the spot that apparently David had said that he tramped through to this point, and it was here that he hitchhiked from here further on.
I mean, we've been driving for a good half an hour, and this bush is incredibly thick, so I'm going to put the drone up here just to get a better idea of the kind of land that we're looking at, because it is incredibly, incredibly rough. I'm standing on the Kopahikawai Highway, and now, with the drone in the air, I'm able to get a great view of the Tairoa River and the dense forest that stretches to the horizon in the direction of Wentworth Valley. It's both incredibly beautiful and incredibly dense. As the crow flies, it's 13 kilometres from the ridge above Wentworth to where I'm standing. I've been told that Tamahere was a machine and could cover big distances with a heavy pack. But by anyone's standards, it's a hell of a hike. Alan and I crowd over the screen, and he points out the first section of the route Tamahere claims he took on April 3rd, 1989. So that's south down that way.
Yeah, so just go around a bit more.
So here's the road.
We're on the road, okay. So go back. There'll be the Tairoa River, it'll be down here somewhere. Keep going.
Yeah, so there's a river that I saw there.
Yeah. That's the Tairoa River there. Rightio, yeah. Ah, that's better. Now see it going around and going way up, and it follows the bottom of that green.
Oh, so that's where he would have come from?
No, yeah, he would have walked down there and come around, or he's come straight up here to here.
Yeah.
But it's neither here nor there.
Mm.
Whichever way he goes, about the same distance. But that's where he's come from, way the...
way up there.
There's the back. So this is where he's come from, and way over in here. Way over.
And all through here. So he's saying... so
it's come along maybe... Wentworth's way over behind there.
Fuck, I mean, that's fucking...
Come all the way along there, and he's dropped down.
Right.
He's come way, from way over the back, come up right along, or somewhere here, and drop down, and then come all the way down.
Oh, I see what you mean, and then he's saying he's come down.
He's come all the way down here, and out either down there or here. And he's got to hitch a ride from here over the other side.
Yeah, I mean, that's fucking... I mean, look at that. I mean, that there's not so bad, obviously, but...
Nah, it's worse than that up there. Fuck's like this. Up there's like this. This sort of country. Yeah. Around there, it'd be bloody, like we just drove around, big steep, it's rugged.
Yes, I mean, so we're parked down here now. So, I mean, look. Alan and I run the drone battery dead, admiring the spectacular scenery, and pack up to head to the next location. But as we drive off, we see a dirt track down into the bush towards the river, so decide to take advantage of our four-wheel drive and make our way down through the trees until it reveals the Tairoa River, snaking its way through the forest over a bed of rocks, made smooth over millions of years. So we've just driven down off the Kopahikawai Road, and David, this is the spot that we surmise that David must have come off and then jumped in the car to hitchhike on State Highway 25. Standing next to the Tairoa River now, which has actually got a bit of a flow to it. It's a beautiful spot. But even from here, looking back up, you know, this is thick bush, native bush. It's we're not talking about pine forest with lots of room to move. We're talking thick, overgrown native bush. You know, I'm not saying that he didn't do it, but walking through here with a 60 plus pound pack that he was renowned for, yeah, it certainly seems a big ask in the time frame that he said he did it. But you know, then he was out in the bush a lot. It's, you know, it's possible, but this is going to be something we're going to put to the test. Yeah, it's beautiful country out here, classic New Zealand. Following State Highway 25, we continue over the summit and down towards Thames. It's not a great distance, and after about 20 minutes, we're driving up the Kauranga Valley towards a campsite known as Boom's Flat. This place is of interest, as it's the location Tamahiti claims he stayed on April 3rd, after his epic sojourn cross-country from the Wentworth Valley. It's also significant for a couple other reasons. In Tamahiti's first ever interview with police in this case, he was asked how he could explain having Heidi and Urban's jacket, binoculars and leggings in his wife's Auckland home. His initial claim was somewhat bizarre in that he claimed he had found a cardboard box sitting at the Boom's Flat campsite, and inside were these items and the packs he pawned in Auckland. Once he realised police knew he had been connected to the vehicle, he changed his story and said he didn't find the items here. But it is somewhat curious as to why he picked Boom's Flat as the spot for this lie. Of course, it would be logical that if he did stay here, as he claims, that this would be a spot he realistically could have found the items. Remember, his story of staying at Boom's Flat on April the 3rd was never corroborated. But is it possible that he somehow knew Heidi and Urban had stayed in this campsite, corroborating his lie that they could have accidentally left a box with the items found in his wife's home? No one knows with certainty where Heidi and Urban spent their nights from April the 6th onwards. The last known location they camped was in Waihee on April 5th. During the police investigation, witnesses came forward from all over the Coromandel saying they had seen the couple between April 5th and 7th. But many of these sightings clashed, and quite simply, they couldn't all be true. However, there was one particular sighting that seems to stand out from the rest. And this was of a couple seen on Saturday, April 8th, at Boom's Flat campsite. So we're heading up Kauranga Valley Road, which runs next to Thames on the other side of Tararu Creek Road. Again, it's pretty bushy, but it's a bit more built up than the other side. There are houses and things along the way. So we're coming up this way because there are a couple potential sightings of Heidi and Urban up this way by some Air Force cadets and then a couple other people. But it's interesting to think why he picked Boom's Flat. Did he know that they had been here? And as a result, you know, that might be corroborated by someone else who might say, oh yeah, I saw them there, so it could make sense that he found this box of things there. So yeah, we're going to go check it out, get some eyes on the ground and see what it looks like. Alan's been up here and looked around a bit before, so he can show me around. So yeah, let's keep driving.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
At 2:45 p.m. on Saturday, April 8th, 1989, a group of 50 New Zealand Air Force cadets were in the Kauranga Valley
and one of these men, Robert Owens, recalled seeing a white Subaru station wagon at a camping area at the top of the valley. As he drove past, he noted the vehicle had gear neatly stacked in the back up to the windows, and even recalled the registration plate began with an H. He stated that as he drove past further, he noticed in the rear vision mirror a bull bar on the front of the car, and remembered thinking it would be good for camping, being a four-wheel drive. He also said it was dusty up the sides. When the cadets passed the same spot 45 minutes later, the vehicle was gone, but about 20 meters from where it had been parked, they recalled seeing a green tent and a woman with blonde collar-length hair and a man with fairish brown hair down to the ears and shoulder length at the back. Both were described as being early to mid-20s and between 5'9" and 6'. The description is an absolute perfect match for Heidi and her barn. And their vehicle registration plate was HF8593, so began with an H, as Robert Owens recalled. However, this sighting was discounted by police as not being the Swedes for one specific detail. How could it be Heidi and her barn if the vehicle had left and they were still there?
Oh, here's Lancer right here. Someone's here. Might as well park in here somewhere.
Yeah, that's where they were parked.
Right, so we've just driven up Karonga Valley Road for a good 15 minutes or so. And yeah, right in the bush now. It's on the way up to Pinnacles, actually, if you're not familiar. But yeah, so we've hopped out here now and there's a campsite. Okay, so where was this? So you know the spot in here.
The Subaru was parked, would have been parked just there, or maybe back down a little bit on the side of the road, and this here would have been a lot shorter then.
We hop out and make our way into the campsite. It's simply an open area of grass in a deep valley, with forest completely surrounding it on all sides. This is not a private site. There are no facilities other than a long drop toilet. It's beautiful, quiet, and with a remote feel, despite being only a short drive from Thames.
Oh, so this is where it was actually, this is where people said they saw it.
Yeah, the
cadets.
Yeah, the cadets.
Oh, so they actually said they saw it right here at Booms.
Yeah, they parked there, remember, when they drove up?
Yeah, okay, yep.
And there was nobody there. Then when they drove down, what was it, about an hour later?
It was gone.
3:30?
Yeah.
The vehicle was gone, but they saw the tent.
I wonder if they could have just moved the vehicle somewhere into a different spot.
Yeah, of course they could have.
I mean, they might have thought, oh, hey, we won't leave it out there. It might get broken into or something. They might have just moved it in behind the trees here somewhere.
So they could have been parked there.
Yeah.
And driven in. But I don't know how high this stuff was. Back then, I think from the old aerial photographs, it's quite short.
Yeah.
So, you know, from the when you drove down and back then, 30 years ago, it might have been quite open and visible here, but they saw the tent round about here somewhere, roughly here from the road, so it's not far.
Yeah.
And this is where they claim they saw the blonde.
Yeah. Yeah, the sighting with that car and just the fact that it had the license plate that with the H, and then the other guy that Graham told me about with the pretty much bang on same license plate up this road as well.
When I spoke to Graham Pierce, the man that found Heidi's jacket up the track to Crosby's clearing, he told me of a local elderly man who was a resident of the Karonga Valley, who said he believed he had also seen the Swede's car up this valley that weekend. So either there's another couple driving the same style of car with a registration plate starting with H, who look exactly the same. Or it was Heidi in her barn. Alan's been up here before and shows me the exact location Tamahiti says he found the box in his initial lie to police, which coincidentally happens to be in the same area the cadets say they saw the couple on Saturday, April 8th.
If you have a look at the map I gave you that Tamahiri drew where he found the gear, and it's right there in the boxes.
Oh, so this is where he said he saw it?
This is where he said he found the gear, the boxes.
I mean, that's too much of a fucking coincidence. Yeah. That you've got people that say they saw a tent here, and then he said he had to have seen them here.
Yeah, so he put a cross about here. It's just here or there. Right, you have a look on the the thing, because when you see his drawing, it comes up, and then the road splits off up there, you can see it.
Yeah, I saw that.
The big pines, they've been cut out now, there's the big pines up behind there. So this is where he claims he found the boxes, right?
Yeah.
Why the fuck would he pick here?
Is it a coincidence that Tamahiti picked this exact spot for his story that he found the box? The same spot the cadets claim to have seen the Swedes. Or is there something more to this? In reality, there were two specific reasons police discounted this sighting. The first is the car being gone. But the second, and more importantly for their case, if this were the Swedes at Booms Flat, then the Crosby's clearing sighting, allegedly of Tamahiti and Heidi, would be impossible, as they couldn't be two places at the same time. Unfortunately, I discovered the cadet that saw the car and the couple at Booms Flat, Robert Owens, recently passed away, so I can't ask him. But for me, I don't see any reasonable explanation as to how this couldn't have been Heidi in her barn. Given the campsite's close proximity to Thames, which was their last known location, the fact no one knows where they camped this night, and that store owner Graham Manning had even recommended this exact location to them 2 days earlier. So how do we explain the car being gone? There is one obvious possibility: that they had met someone who, for whatever reason, was moving or using their car.
So leaving Booms Flat now, we're heading back down and can't help but feel that if the cadets did see the tent and everything in the car in this place they said they did, and that's also the same place Tamahiti said that he saw the box, it's a hell of a coincidence.
We leave the Kauranga Valley and head south out of Thames, making the turn off to Maritoto, and the site of the location Tamahiti camped on April 1st, before he made his way over the Wires track and down into the Wentworth Valley on April the 2nd. Today, it's just a wet, empty paddock at the base of a hill. We climb a fence and find the exact tree Tamahiti likely camped under 34 years earlier. Alan and his extensive knowledge of the Coromandel has become an invaluable resource for me during this investigation. He spent years of his life in this backcountry, trapping possums and hunting.
Okay, so we've just gone down Wires Road, and we're at the Maritoto car park. Well, not car park, we're at the Maritoto, the old campground. We've just crossed where the stream comes down. There's a ford. And now we're just walking into the old campground. She's pretty boggy. So this is where Tamahiti says that before he ended up going over to Wentworth, he got dropped off, walked up here and camped a night. And someone actually saw him camping here with a fire. And this is the tocha tree that he was camped under.
Yeah, one of these two.
And then which way does the track go from here?
There was a toilet over here, an old long drop.
Oh, okay.
And
I think this was the Boy Scouts campground, I think they called it. And that's your road that goes up, we'll go up there in a minute. And it goes up to the end, and that's where the track starts.
Oh, okay.
And the wires goes, the wires track, they call it, goes right up. And then you've got this circle track. Then it drops down into the Wentworth Valley. It's, you come down into the Wentworth Falls.
Yep.
So this is where the chap and his two sons, I think, were chatting to. Tamahiri, and there was another sighting, the landowner who came up to sight his rifle in, remember?
Yep.
He was talking to him as well.
Oh,
so
okay.
There was half, you know, half a dozen people.
Oh, so he was definitely here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
He even says himself.
Yep.
That he used to camp here, and then he walked up the back. Yep. And
so from here to Wentworth, he'd get there in a day?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. So it's just up and over?
Yeah, it's probably about three hours, right. 2 or 3 hours away.
Oh, so probably on, yeah. Yeah, okay.
We hop back in the ute and make the 5-minute drive up the hill to the start of the Wires track over to Wentworth, which is so named due to the power lines that once ran across, connecting the two valleys.
So we're now at the Wires car park, so this is where you can go right over the top and down into Wentworth. So it says 6 hours, but you know, you could do it a lot quicker than that, more than likely. And so this is where Tamahiri said he came over to here to get to Wentworth, where it all sort of started. The tracks, she's not in the best state, but it's not too bad. Pretty wet. People get up here with their dirt bikes, do they? Yeah. Or they maybe at some point.
Visiting all these locations has really helped me better understand how connected all these places are. But also, how thick and remote this bush truly is. There's no doubt that David Tamahiri was extremely capable in the bush. He could cover huge amounts of ground, even with his heavy pack. But the question is, did he, between the dates of April 3rd and April 10th? It's within this window of time that Heidi and her barn would disappear. And it is during this time that there are no official witness sightings of Tamahiri noted by police. Of course, we've now got Barry Lindsay describing a man driving Heidi and her barn up Parakawai Quarry Road who fits Tamahiri's description. But we don't know exactly what date this sighting took place. And if that was Tamahiri, how did he end up driving their car, with them in it, casually, 73 kilometres away from Thames, the last place they were seen? What's the connection? What you're about to hear is what can only be described as a bombshell. During my investigation, I've discovered a new, previously unheard witness that I believe holds that missing piece.
Hey, Murray, how are you?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I'll check you out the one, but
Right. Okay, I'll just get my jersey. It's quite warm, actually.
Yeah, it's lovely over here. Frost there this morning.
Wicked frost.
Yeah. It was only a little one here.
Oh, no, we had a good one.
That voice is Murray Jenkins. I received an email from him only the day before this interview, and given the importance of what he told me, made the drive the very next morning to his home.
What a cool place. I like those kind of like things like that. It's quite good. Cool.
Yeah, well, just a little bit different.
Yeah, no, it's good. It gives a bit of character, eh?
Yeah.
How far through the podcast did you get? Or did you just listen to 10 minutes?
I listened to about 10 minutes, and then I thought, well, if I keep on listening, it might bugger up my...
Yeah, nice. I like that.
Yeah, so I stopped listening.
Murray is the perfect example
of the benefits of a live investigation like this. Having come across the podcast, he listened to only 10 minutes before realizing something extremely important and hitting pause. The hairdressers in Thames that were the last that ever officially saw Heidi in her barn? Well, that's not true, he thought. Because I was.
Right, Murray Jenkins. I was working for Archer's Auto Springs doing pickup and deliveries all around the North Island. And I can't remember if it was a Wednesday or a Friday, but I think it was a Friday was my day to go to Thames. And I stopped in at Terry Jeffcoat's at Kopu, on Kopu Road. Probably around 10 o'clock. I normally got there about smoko time. Was leaving the yard, and the white Subaru came towards me, and the reason I noticed was the bull bar on the front, and I thought, what a good idea, because they're a four-wheel drive wagon, and I thought, well, that'd be good for hunting. And as they come past, there was a stunning looking girl in the passenger seat, and there was a white guy driving. But the strange thing was, there was a Maori boy sitting in the middle of the back seat and just looked out of place. And when I looked at him, we made eye contact, and he just come across with a guilty looking look. I don't, for no apparent reason. And they drove past. There was a couple of packs I could see in the back of the station wagon, and that was it.
That was it. The most simple, innocuous sighting, but carrying importance beyond what Murray could have ever possibly imagined. Had he come forward at the time of the investigation, I have no doubt this sighting would have been a bedrock of the police's case.
How fast was the car going past you?
Slow. Well, it had come around the intersection and there was probably cars in front of it.
Yeah.
Probably 30-40k, yep. I suppose.
Yep.
Yeah, there was packs. You could see the packs sticking up.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. It's hard to remember.
Oh, I understand.
But I think there was the packs that were down flat would look like those European type packs, but there was another one. I'm pretty sure there was another one in there, like the old New Zealand ones, the wooden frame.
With a frame on it.
Yeah.
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 Ah, okay.
But it's a long time ago now.
That would be, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
The
way they were talking, the way she turned around and talked to him is as though he'd just got in the car. But I'm only guessing.
Well, I don't need to stress enough to you about how important this sighting is. Did you speak to the police at any time?
Sort of. I went to the Thames police station a couple of times and there was no one there, whether it was unmanned or what. So I didn't, but I come back here and I spoke to a mate of mine who lived down the road. He's a cop, and I told him about it, and I never heard anything more about it. But that was when the court case was going on.
Is there any way that we could, I know that you know that it was that time, but is there any way we could somehow confirm that it was 1989 that you saw?
Well, I worked for Archers from 89 to 99. It was a set route that I'd done.
Oh, so there could be some way to figure out where you would have roughly been?
I always got to Terry's about smoko, because I used to have smoko with him. So I normally got there about 10 o'clock.
Yeah, on a Friday.
On a Friday, if it was a Friday. I'm pretty sure it was.
Friday would make sense.
I would go, I'd come up to Moranville, Waitar, Tahuna, Kirape, Thames, or Kopu, Thames, down to Pairoa, Waihi, Tauranga, and then end up in Whakatane, and back to Rotorua.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a regular.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a one-off, it was a regular.
If Barry's sighting was the nail then this sighting is the hammer. Not only does Murray say that he saw Heidi and her barn in their white Subaru with a Māori man, but he can even give me a date and a time. Murray used to do a regular route for his deliveries. Monday one area, Tuesday another, and so on. The same every week. And every Friday, he would visit Thames. And on that Friday, he would always stop at the same spot around Smoko or break time. In New Zealand, this is normally between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. The road has changed somewhat since 1989, but Murray pulls out his laptop and shows me the exact spot he saw the car that morning.
Yeah. That's the way you used to turn off here to go to the bridge. That was the turn off. Okay. There's a pub on the corner there.
Yeah.
And Terry's place was in here. I think it's the testing station now.
Okay. So you came out of here?
I came out of one of these driveways here.
Went that way?
And went that way. Might have been this driveway. But it's, you know, the driveway might have been over this side then. But say I come out of there,
yep.
That car was coming from this way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's going that way?
Yeah, it was going towards the Kaupo Bridge.
So on my map here, just so yeah, you were here, you saw them going that direction as if they just... So that wasn't there. Was that road not there either?
Where should we give us a look?
So that's where the VTNZ is.
So there's the bridge. See that white road there? Yeah, well, VTNZ is where...
Spot.
That's the spot.
Right there, and you saw them going in this direction?
Yep.
So they must have... They've just come around this bend here?
Yeah.
Okay. And she was leaning back, talking to him?
So I'm in the passenger seat. She turned this way to and was talking to him.
Yeah.
I seen her before in Rotorua. She was at a car sales because she was stunning. And but I didn't realise at the time. It didn't all come together until everything was on the news. But yeah, she'd been in Rotorua.
Okay, because she was in Rotorua, yeah.
Yeah.
That would have been, I think they were in Rotorua maybe a week earlier or something like that.
Right? Yeah, I really don't know. It's just
that was part of your route that you would do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what everyone says. She stood out.
Yeah.
Especially back in those times.
Yeah, and that's when I seen him in the back seat. I thought, what are you, you know, it just didn't look right. What are you doing in there? Mm. But, you know, I'd...
And your intuition at the time when you saw that was that...
It was strange.
And that they'd probably picked him up,
hitchhiked. Yeah.
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 Hmm.
Yeah. And I don't know if it was... If he was in the car when they come around the corner, I don't know.
Yeah.
He was there long here when he was in the car.
Okay. How long, like?
Oh, down to the shoulders, I suppose.
Oh, that long?
Yeah, it was...
Okay. Anything else about him you could remember?
No, I think he... Oh, no, not really. Now it's a bit too long.
Yeah.
But he was a fine-looking guy. He was a handsome-looking dude.
Yeah.
And long hair, beard.
Beard, okay.
I'm pretty sure it was a beard, yeah. Yeah, he just looked shady. You know, you come from this place, you can spot... Spot things that, you know, and it just didn't look right. But the way that he sat in the car and the way that she was talking to him, it just seemed to me they were new. They'd just met. But.
Like as if they'd just met, he's put his gear in and.
Yeah, and she's having a yarn to him.
Where do you want to go? Where are you?
Yeah. Yeah. They went past me. It was, I think it would have been between 10 and 11.
Yeah.
Because I normally got there about 10 o'clock. There was normally smoker time when I got there.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. She stuck out to you.
Yeah. Well, so did he, because he just, what's that Maori boy doing in there?
Yeah. And in the back, of the car when it went past? What distance away from the car were you?
Roughly. 3-4 meters.
Oh, really?
I suppose, yeah. You're parked on, you know, you're parked to come out of the driveway. It's like sitting in the driveway and the car goes past, you know, so. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess they're going kind of slow because you just come around that
corner.
Around
the corner, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and there were packs in the back. I could see packs in the back, but I'm pretty sure there was an oddball, something oddball on top of the flash ones. The frame pack, yeah. Yeah, and there was, I'm pretty sure there was one of those on the top of the two European packs. But, yeah.
Have you, over the years since then, have you researched this case or looked read books or anything like that?
No, just if it comes up on the news or whatever.
Yeah. So you wouldn't know all the details of all the bits of equipment they have and all that stuff?
No, I have no idea.
Okay.
And that's why I stopped listening to that pod. I didn't want to...
Yeah, to taint yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you did the right thing, Murray. Yeah, this is going to be big. I guess what for me is the most important part is, and that's the thing, I know it's very difficult, but if there was a way to... You think it was the Friday. If there was a way to pin it onto the Friday...
It was Friday because it was the same run every week.
Oh, so that was your Friday run.
That was my Friday run.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
That's ideal. Oh, that makes sense anyway.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Different route every day.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But some days you'd go to the place you went to. Say if it was a Monday, might go to the same place again on a Wednesday.
Right. Yeah.
But
you only went here on Fridays.
Yeah. It was only one day a week.
Okay, so it's always. Now that makes perfect sense. Fucking the amazing thing is you can place a time on it. That's fantastic.
Might have been hitchhiking here. You know, that's just the impression that I got, was that he had just got in the car. You know, he hadn't been in the car long.
Mm.
Was the impression I had, but
yeah,
yeah.
Like Barry's sighting, we'll get into the possible identification of this Māori man in the car in a later episode. But Murray describes him as being rough, like he'd been in the bush for a while. But the main thing is that he felt it was an odd fit for that man to be in the car with that couple. I understand that this implies certain racial stereotypes, and this sighting likely wouldn't be viewed in the same way today. But nonetheless, this is what made it stand out to both Barry and Murray at the time in 1989. So it is important. But like Barry said, what the hell is that guy doing in that car with that girl? Crucially, Murray's sighting gives us a time and a date. With all things taken into consideration, it must be between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. on Friday, April 7th, 1989. Despite what Murray had believed, this makes his sighting a few hours before the couple would be seen at the hairdressers. And notably, Murray recalls the blonde girl's hair being tied back, i.e. that it hadn't yet been cut. As with any case, everything can hang on the smallest moments. Murray said his gut feeling was that they had just picked up the man hitchhiking. In the back, he thinks he saw two expensive-looking European packs, then a larger New Zealand-style pack with a frame thrown on top. David Tamahedi also carried a tramping pack that fits this exact description. And its position on top of the other packs would indicate that they had picked this man up hitchhiking, and he'd simply thrown his pack on top. Now let's consider the location Murray saw the car. Almost directly off the end of the State Highway 25 Kopuhikawai Highway. The same road Tamahedi claims to have hitchhiked down 4 days earlier,
although this was never corroborated. Whoever gave him a ride that day never came forward. Is it possible that there's a reason why they never came forward? Because they couldn't. Did David Tamahedi emerge from the Coromandel Forest on State Highway 25, stick out his hand, and catch a ride with a friendly Swedish couple in a white Subaru station wagon, who then drove right past Murray Jenkins? Is this the missing piece? The place where it all began. A fateful meeting. Or is there something more? Questions yet unanswered. You bet. This is only the beginning. And in the final six episodes of this season of Guilt, you're going to hear the truth. And it's beyond what you could have ever imagined.
We went to Mount Egmont National Park. That's on the western side of the North Island. We found a nice camping spot that was also cheap, and the guy who ran the site invited us for dinner. They served lamb chops, beef, salad and potatoes. For dessert, we got Mum's fruit salad and ice cream. It was a really nice meal for us. We're going to Coromandel and Rotorua. It feels strange that it's Good Friday today, because at home it's going towards spring when Easter comes, and here it's the other way around. They've got a special Easter bread here. Urban likes it. It's spiced, so it tastes almost like soft ginger cake, and there's some raisins and fruit in it. Sorry this letter is so messy, but it's a bit hard to write in the light of the candle. Heidi.
Guilt is a Brevity Studios production. Written, produced, and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that, opinions, and are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Voice acting in this episode, Anna Waddell as Heidi. If you have any information related to the murders of Heidi and Urban, you can email us anonymously at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com. You'll find further photos and video on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ. And I highly recommend you join the discussion with thousands of Guilt listeners on Facebook at the Guilt Podcast Discussion Group. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding. You can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details in the show notes of every episode. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.